What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene, baby, me and you. On my rocking bicycle that's built for two. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. It's Wednesday, January 11th. And for today's show, I have a bunch of little clips from around town. First of all, though, if anyone knows their birds, it was such a warm day today, and I was hearing some bird songs I didn't recognize. If you know what bird song this is, give me a call here at the studio, 585-1033, and you can let me and all the other listeners know. All right, if you know what bird that is, call 585-1033. I was trying to look to see it, but all I could do was squint up into the tree, and I didn't see anything. So for today's show, I have some clips from sledding on Hospital Hill on Sunday. James Lowenthal, an astronomer at Smith College, talking about a conference he went to in the last week or two, he was talking about geoengineering as well as the light pollution and a program you can download or install on your computer called F-Lux that will reduce the amount of blue light that comes off your screen at night. Also, Francis Crowe saying a few things. I ran into someone who was hitchhiking in front of the post office this morning when I was working. I got a little clip from her. And Mary Beth Brooker from Northampton talking about writing and writing groups in the valley. Let's go sledding. How's it feel being out here on the sledding hill, Clarissa?
I feel great. I feel pumped. I'm at the top. I haven't gone down yet, so I have anticipation, excitement.
I counted about 25 other people all walking up the hill at the same time as us. Now they're all down. How about you, Linge? How's it feel? How you feeling about going sledding?
Excited. Just actually my really second time come here. So, yeah, still excited about it. But I'm cold.
All right. We should go so we can come back up again. She went far. Wow. They go so far on those tubes.
Right?
How is your lid?
Pretty good. It's hard to, when you go down, your body, kind of move forward. Mm. So it's hard to control it, hold it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah.
Okay. Pretty good. I didn't ride it all the way up because then I was kind of wafting. I put my feet down. I'm out of breath. So.
Okay. How about you? What do you like about sledding?
I like the view.
Yes.
It's a nice view of the valley. Yeah.
Do you have any other favorite places?
No, I think this is the best.
Yeah.
So, do y'all come here often?
Actually. More often than I do, but the only reason I don't come here all that often is because I actually live in New York, but it's a lot of fun.
You come here often?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you live in Northampton?
Yes.
So is this like your favorite place to come?
Kind of.
You know what's that?
Like I like it, but I have another place I like.
Can you share where is it?
It's like near her. It's like somewhere around there. I don't know.
So you all have snowboards.
Yes. I can show you.
How does snowboarding compare to sledding?
You can sled with a snowboard, but
you can control where you're going.
Easier.
You know, yeah, yeah.
The first thing you learn when you're snowboarding is how to take a hard fall. So, yeah.
How long have you been snowboarding?
Since last year.
All three of us.
Yeah.
Same thing.
We know how to go backwards down a hill.
Wow, that's cool.
Do you encourage other people to come out here and sled or snowboard?
We'll go down one more time, we'll leave.
This is a really good hill.
Can you tell me which is better, a sled, like a plastic sled like that, or an inner tube?
Inner tube.
The inner tube's better, for sure.
And what's the pros and cons?
On this one, you smack your butt and you land after a jump.
Oh, yeah. We noticed that.
And this one, you're cushioned.
Yeah, I flipped over in that sled.
In the plastic one?
Yeah. This one, I just go really fast down the hill.
Cool.
Sure, no problem.
I've never flipped over this.
You've never flipped over in an inner tube?
Nope.
Yeah. Cool.
Not this one, at least.
Yeah. All right, that's a report from Hospital Hill. That's sledding on the hill behind Smith College Athletic Fields off of Route 66. That was on Sunday. I think after today's warm weather, I don't think there's any snow or not enough out there now. The next snowstorm, find a tube, a lid, something. Get out there. All right, next we have James Lowenthal, an astronomy professor at Smith College, talking about geoengineering.
Well, I just got back from the American Astronomical Society meeting outside of Dallas, Texas, where I led a special session, to discuss geoengineering of the atmosphere to combat climate change, and specifically with the hook, should astronomers worry about it, to which the answer is yes. But on the larger picture, first of all, I'll assume everybody knows what climate change is and why it's important. Now, what is geoengineering? Geoengineering is a whole...
Can I sit down?
No, this is fine. Geoengineering is a whole family of ideas that have been floated in recent years to combat global climate change by changing the atmosphere intentionally, in addition to the unintentional changes that we've already committed. Mm-hmm. And the premise is, first of all, we're already way past the target goals of CO2. We're way past 350 parts per million. We're already now at an average of more than 400 parts per million. CO2 has a very long time scale in the atmosphere. So whatever is there now is going to be there for literally thousands of years. So we're at an elevated level now. The temperature hasn't caught up to it yet. And the experts all agree there's basically no way we can even keep to the Paris COP21 targets. There's no way we can. Even if we stopped producing carbon dioxide right now, if we shut down all the factories in the world, stopped all the cars in the world, stopped producing all the electrical power in the world, we would still exceed the Paris COP21 1.5 degree Celsius rise. So geoengineering premise is, well, given that and given the terrible damage that's going to be wrought all around the world as a result of climate change that's already been set in place, shouldn't we at least study and possibly implement intentional changes that could mitigate it? And the family of solutions proposed includes two major subfamilies. One, take the carbon dioxide out and stuff it under the ground, which is called carbon sequestration, or else under the ocean, put something in the atmosphere that would reduce the amount of sunlight coming in, which could be SO2 particles, sulfur dioxide.
Coal power plants.
Yeah, except that's at low elevation, so it would be in some controlled way at high elevation with the right amount in the stratosphere that would reflect the right amount of sunlight to counteract the global warming that's already happened. And I went into this session, so I invited three experts and one astronomer, three geoscientists and one astronomer to sit on a panel and discuss this, present their own views and answer questions, have a discussion. It was well attended. We had about 100 astronomers, professional astronomers there, including heads of major observatories. And And the panelists were David Grinspoon, who's recently written a new book called The Earth in Human Hands. And he writes about the Anthropocene, you know, the new geological era that Earth has now entered with humans at the steering wheel, whether they like it or not. Tom Ackerman, who's a professor and institute head at University of Washington, and Jane Long, recently retired from Lawrence Livermore National Lab. And those three are all experts on the atmosphere. And then Mel Ulmer, who was an astronomer at Northwestern, who came in saying, this is nuts. It's unethical and dangerous and certainly bad for astronomy, to say the least. The other three people all agreed the number one priority has to be cutting carbon emissions and bringing it to zero as quickly as possible, that has to be the number one priority. But given the amount of CO2 already there and the longevity of it in the atmosphere, that's not enough, and that it's unethical not to try to mitigate the terrible changes that have already been set in motion, and that the only ethical thing to do is to study and then implement the best mitigation strategies that we can. And I went in thinking, look, if we don't know enough about the, you know, about society and the economy and the atmosphere to control the inadvertent emissions, how could we possibly understand it enough to actually try to make a fix? And they countered that. And they said, that's just not true, and that it's much more ethical to try to do something about it, that the risks are, they're convinced, at least two of them, the risks of intentional geoengineering are much less than the certain risks of serious climate change, and that the timescales are much shorter. So if it doesn't work, whatever aerosols we inject in the stratosphere will settle out on the timescale of a couple of years, not a millennia the way it is with carbon dioxide, or decades the way it is with methane. And some of the proposals include artificial brightening of clouds over the oceans, which would have minimal impact over the land masses, it is claimed. So, in other words, these are people who have deep ethical, a deep conscience, a social ethic. They're thinking profoundly about what's the right thing to do, and is there a role for a technological solution? And if so, we need to know it. And they further point out that even if the United States doesn't do it, and Canada doesn't do it, and Russia and China don't do it, and even if there's no international agreement that there should be a geoengineering solution to climate change, somebody's going to do it. Some nation is going to decide, well, to hell with you guys, we're doing it anyway, and they're going to pump stuff into the atmosphere. And we better understand it first. So more research is needed to understand the pros and cons of different methods. So that was their argument. And I came out convinced, at the very least, okay, better understand it because somebody's going to do it. I'm not happy about it, but I have a new sense of urgency about it that I didn't have going in.
One of the arguments you heard is we're already engineering the atmosphere by pouring all the CO2 into it.
Oh, sure.
So the the argument about we can't engineer the atmosphere, it's we're past that.
Right.
Ethically,
right. Part of that argument, you know, my feeling, I'm sure shared by many people, is I just want it to stop, and I want it to go back to the way it was. I want it to stop doing the damage, and the Earth will heal itself, and that's just not going to happen. We've already done the damage, and the damage is very long term, and we're doing more damage that will be long term. We can't go back, and there is no stable natural state of the Earth that we can return to anytime soon. And accepting that is difficult, and I'm only partway there.
Right.
But it's partway along the path of accepting maybe something like geoengineering as a way to mitigate pain and suffering for humans and animals. And
so what are some of the scenarios for starlight coming, you know, into our lives?
Yeah, first of all, of course, when we floated that, the response from the panelists, who are not astronomers, was, sorry, but astronomy doesn't have a voice here. I mean, you have a voice, but it just doesn't matter compared to the survival of humanity or civilization and plant and animal species. Who cares if astronomy suffers for a few decades?
Right.
But sure enough, astronomy will definitely suffer for decades if a geoengineering, an atmospheric geoengineering approach is followed. There's a recent paper that predicts if we adopt SAI, stratospheric aerosol injection, at a level estimated to be the right amount to counteract the current amount of climate change we have now, that it would brighten the sky over cities by an additional 25%, because the aerosol particles would reflect the city lights downward, and it would dim the incoming starlight, scattering light twice as much as it is currently scattered. So it would have a huge effect on ground-based astronomy. Yeah.
So the astronomers will have to, like, move to Mars or somewhere? Or how? I mean.
Yeah, we would...
to the moon?
Were your space telescopes?
Only telescopes out... No, only telescopes outside the atmosphere would not be affected.
What is the implication for light pollution, though?
Worse in cities, yeah. Our view of the stars would be impacted, for sure. I have to admit that worry just pales in comparison to the much bigger issues
of
the stability of the climate.
Yeah. But could it be lessened with better engineered light down here?
Yes, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, light pollution is easily solved with the flick of a switch, fortunately, mm-hmm. and that one mm-hmm. is not long-lasting.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you turn the lights off, the light pollution goes away.
Right.
Or as soon as you put in a better light.
Right.
To change a whole city to better lights takes a lot of work, and we're fighting that fight now, including here in Northampton, of course.
So, what do you think about the new LED lights that the city has put in?
Well, they sure are nice and bright. They sure are white. Basically, it's one helpful thing about it is we don't need to turn the lights on in our house anymore. Because the lights shine right into the kitchen and right into the second floor guest room
and
right into my daughter's bedroom.
Mm-hmm. So they're saving a lot of electricity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, not really. So the truth is I hate the new lights. It literally hurts my eyes outside now with the snowy street and the snowy sidewalks. The light is so bright and so blue rich white that it makes my eyes hurt. And I have to squint, and I really haven't seen the stars from our Crescent Street since the lights went in, because I'm not looking up anymore, because it hurts too much. I'm shielding my eyes from those lights. I haven't taken my telescope out in the backyard, because the backyard's now flooded with bright white light.
So before you had a shield on the light, on the street light outside your house, are you... going to be able to get another shield or what?
I hope so. The city has a program for requesting a shield, and I haven't seen it work yet, but we'll see. I'm worried that the city's planning only a sort of halfway shield, not the full-way shield. The halfway shield's called a house-side shield. It works only front to back. In fact, only back. Only I think it's only one direction. You can, I think, install it frontwards or backwards, either stopping the light thrown behind the lamppost or in front of it. Mm-hmm. But I think we should also think about the light being cast up and down the street. Mm-hmm. For instance, our street is curved, and the two neighboring lights, not the one right outside our house, also cast light into our house, and the house side shield won't change that. So I think we should install the four-directional so-called cul-de-sac shield.
So more information about that is available on the city's website, right?
Yes, that's right.
Do you have any suggestions for people looking at the website of things to keep in mind?
First of all, is that street light really making you safer? And does it have to be so bright? And how do you feel about the fact that... blue light at night is linked with elevated cancer rates and elevated obesity and diabetes rates and disruption of sleep patterns, circadian rhythms. These new lights have, I think, something on the order of 50% more blue light than the old lights, notwithstanding what the city claims, which is no change. And that blue light is what's exactly linked, that's exactly what triggers suppression of melatonin in humans. And melatonin is a really important hormone. We need it. Our bodies need it.
Any thoughts on how this LED streetlights compare with people at home looking at their computer screens and cell phones anyway?
Well, that they can control. The lights are on all the time. The computers and cell phones, by the way, if you don't already have the app F.Lux, F period L-U-X, it's a free app that tells your computer to reduce the blue light as after the sun sets. It's a game changer. It's a fantastic. It's my favorite app of all time. And new cell phones now also come with a similar setting that reduces the blue light at night, so that it won't inhibit production of melatonin.
Thanks, James.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ruthie. Do you use a laptop computer?
Yes.
Do you use it at night? Sometimes.
Sometimes.
F.Lux. Just fantastic.
Yeah, you'll just see it kind of gets really glowy and gold, and it just, and then there's a little message
that if it stops working, it's like
it suddenly goes back to blue, and it's,
you realize,
oh,
it's
really,
it's,
yeah,
you, and realize. You realize you've been living with that for years.
Yeah,
it's,
you don't
so dramatic.
It get darker and darker.
Yeah. The other thing is, there's a little message that comes up and says, "You're waking up in 8 hours." Like, oh, what the hell am I doing on my computer?
Yeah.
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 Little note.
Tonight.
So that was an interview with James Lowenthal and also Mary Beth Brooker and their daughter Mel. James is an astronomy professor at Smith College. We'll hear more from Mary Beth later on in the show, talking about writing and being involved in writing groups. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Next clip I'm going to play. Oh, yeah. This is a Francis Crowe announcing movie tonight.
Tonight, the Northampton Committee to Stop War will be further exploring the Rosenberg case, which was, you know, during the McCarthy era in the 50s, when Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were put to death by our government because... I guess Julius gave some information to the Russian government about the nuclear weapon, and his wife was not involved at all, but she wanted to support him, and the government took the lives of both. And their granddaughter has made a film about the case. And she's going to be showing it tonight at Forbes Library at 6:30. And her father, Robert Maripol, one of the Rosenbergs' younger son, will be there to talk about it. So I think it'll be a very interesting program. They're asking Obama to kind of exonerate their mother now that he is leaving office. He has the possibility of doing that. So I'm looking forward to the evening very much. So I hope many people will join us.
Do you have any thoughts about today's relationship with the Russians and hacking and secrets and any parallels?
I think what we're living now is in a time like Hitler reigned. Mm-hmm. And so I can't keep up with the latest lies. But, you know, last night I watched the president's speech. Very depressing program. He talks about all the great things he's done. He never mentioned war or nuclear weapons. And those are my issues. So, you know, and then watching Command and Control afterwards, the Titan missile that blew up in Arkansas back when we were... you know, had all these nuclear weapons. We still have nuclear weapons all over the Northwest. And it's a very wonderful film, and I urge people to see it.
You're talking about Command and Control or the one tonight? I'm sure both, probably.
Yeah, it's Command and Control was on PBS television last night. And Eric Schlosser, it's based on the book that Eric Schlosser made, Command and Control, about our nuclear weapons program. And this is one of the many accidents we've had with nuclear weapons. But the great thing about Eric Schlosser, he shows the humanity of people who struggle to work on these things and keep people safe, and how many people lost their lives because they went in and tried to divert this weapon from taking off. And they suffered horrible burns and suffered and died. So, you know, I think it was hard for me to sleep after that.
Yeah. All right, that was Frances Crow. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. So also other events coming up on Monday, January 16th. It's Martin Luther King Day. There's events all over the valley. One in particular is a film and discussion with Frances Crow at 1 o'clock at the Friends Meeting House. The film is The Doctrine of Discovery. And The Doctrine of Discovery, that's a theological document that originated in the early European church and is still used as a legal basis for ignoring and invalidating claims to property by Native American communities. Some churches have rejected it. Anyway, so that film is on Martin Luther King Day, Monday at 1. All kinds of other great events on Martin Luther King Day. You can check out the AFSC, American Friends Service Committee of Western Mass website or Facebook page. And what did I have next? Oh, I was going to take a little jazz interlude. This is my housemate Clarissa and some of her friends just chilling in the living room the other day. it's my housemate Clarissa and some of her friends. It's one of the joys of living in community, living with housemates who play music and invite their friends over to play music. So next, today's show, this is Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. And next on today's show, I have a minute and a half of someone who, when I was emptying the downtown trash barrels this morning, they were standing on Route 9 in front of the post office with their thumb out, dressed in very nice office going to work kinds of clothes.
So how long have you been out here?
I just got out here like 5 minutes ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. I already feel like I'm having bad luck, though, because I walked up the hill from my friend's house, and I didn't get a ride while I was walking down here.
But. Yeah. Because the bus is on no school schedule, right? It's
like, that's right. But I usually hitchhike anyway because because my work is hard to get to from the bus. Yeah.
How long does it usually take you?
Well, sometimes I get a ride right away.
Yeah.
I feel like either I get a ride as I'm walking or it takes me 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That seems to be a trend, at least in the morning.
Mm-hmm. How often do you get a ride from someone you know?
Well, someone I know. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Like, I mean, randomly. When
you're
out here.
Oh. Oh, you mean like if I ask for a ride?
No, if you're standing out here with your thumb out and someone's talking, you're like, oh, hi, I know you.
It happens, but not too often.
Yeah.
But I do get repeat rides from people I've gotten, that I sort of know.
Yeah.
So that also happens, like, pretty often.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I don't usually remember people because I hitchhike all the time, but.
Yeah. Do you want to encourage people to give you a ride if they see you?
Yes, definitely. Please give me a ride and please join me in hitchhiking if you want.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Good luck.
Next on today's show, this is Out There. We're going to hear from Mary Beth Brooker about writing and writing circles. I talked with Mary Beth in the same room as I was talking with James Lowenthal and also their daughter, Mel.
So I look at this Celebrating Writers of the Pioneer Valley anthology and think about writing. Like, why write?
Yeah, why write?
Why write?
Yeah. I mean, some people feel that you write to understand your own thoughts.
Yeah.
And even more, you discover thoughts, you discover ideas, you sort of pursue one idea and it leads to another one and another one, and before you know it, you're surprised mm-hmm. at where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really exciting. Mm-hmm. It's a way, I think, to follow your mind.
Mm-hmm.
And to draw on things that you know and explore things you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And to be, put yourself in someone else's shoes,
mm-hmm.
which is always interesting.
Yeah.
To give yourself another voice, to be in that position of what would it be to live this other life in this other place and have these other questions or concerns.
Yeah.
And that's a really neat way to exercise some kind of empathy or compassion.
Yes.
Yeah. I think actors do the same thing. You know, they sort of get into someone else's head or life or body,
mm-hmm.
in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure it's different for different people, but
mm-hmm.
like, how much of writing is for the writer and the writer's process, and how much of it is like just wanting to share and wanting to like affect other people with your work?
It's interesting. I think sort of on a... Sometimes, you pick up a pen or you start writing because there's something that's bugging you or there's something you feel like you need to say, just even to yourself. Or, and then before you know it... I would say that the sort of... The beauty and the mystery of writing with other people and sharing your work with other people, even in an intimate writing group where you've only got 10 other, you've an audience of 10 thoughtful, kind listeners,
mm-hmm.
is that you write something that you think is very personal and very idiosyncratic and really only you are going to understand because it's in your own head and, it's
mm-hmm.
your own quirky internal dialogue. And then you read it out, and then you read it out to your friendly listeners, and they hear it, and they identify with it, and they hear things that you didn't hear, mm-hmm. and they sort of bring it a new life.
Uh-huh.
And they say, "Oh, do you notice how that first part connected to that last part?" And I, you know, I would say, "No," but now that you mention it, yeah. you know, or do you see the continuity, the thread that's running through it? And you don't always see it, but when you read it out, you hear that, and it's mm-hmm. it's kind of wonderful. It's mm-hmm. it's you feel almost more. Well, you certainly feel that you're communicating. So this mm-hmm. very personal thing is now shared, mm-hmm. and it's no longer yours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's funny.
In that isolating way, you know.
I started to write a little story the other day, and I just read the beginnings of it to some housemates.
Yeah.
And the character that I started out with, in my mind, yeah. I was writing it to be someone else. When I read it to my housemates, they sort of giggled and was like, "Oh, I wonder who that character is."
Oh, they recognize.
I was like, "Oh, maybe you're right."
Yes,
that's not how I meant it, though.
That's fascinating. Right. So it's like suddenly that you have this whole new perspective on your own.
Yeah.
Your own thoughts. Yeah. Your own imagination.
Yeah. But I really like what you say about it. You practice, you know, that empathy.
Yeah.
Taking on some what it might be like to be someone else.
Right.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. Yeah.
So do you, like, what is your writing practice like? Like, when, where, how much? Does it take discipline? Is it just spout out of you?
Oh, I think most people would say it takes discipline if you have a project or if you have something that you, I suppose it's like music or any art form, that if you want to reach some kind of, you know, formal proficiency, but also there's a way, and meditators say this, if you sit a little bit every day, if mm-hmm. you're quiet every day, even just for a few moments, it comes more easily, it comes more naturally. You sort of lay the tracks and you mm-hmm. can go there more quickly. And there's something really rewarding and valuable in and of itself about sitting with your pencil and paper, just to sort of quiet your mind and focus. So what's the writing practice? I like to write in the mornings when my head is not so cluttered with this and that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's not very long. It might even be 10 or 20 minutes. And sometimes I get the luxury of an hour and a half, mm-hmm. and sometimes even longer. But sometimes I start with a project or an idea that I want to finish this chapter or this story or this paragraph even or mm-hmm. this sentence. Mm-hmm. And other times it's just free, like no agenda, and see what comes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So have you published anything? How long have you been writing, and have you published anything?
So writing for, let's say, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the Gallery of Readers Press is celebrating Writers of the Pioneer Valley in its anthology of 2017. And there are, I don't know how many writers, but it's a long list. And I'm really honored to be among them.
At least 100.
At least, I would think. And it's a big, chunky book. It's really interesting. It's super broad in its scope, from poems to short stories to humor to poignant things that are quite abstract to things that are very, you know, sort of straightforward.
And you have something. A piece in here.
Yeah, I do have a piece in there. Yeah.
I asked you about publishing things. I was just trying to get at the importance of just process and being who we are.
Yeah.
Whether or not there's what society might call tangible results, or I don't know. Can you speak of that?
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. well, as someone who doesn't pursue publishing very actively, and that's a kind of dilemma, and also an interesting position to be in, because we are a society that measures things, you know, in certain ways. You know, what do you have to show for it? Mm-hmm. That's really important, and I would not reject, you know, the opportunity to share work in a broader community mm-hmm. and having something published. And I really find this local community so supportive and so gratifying that we can read to each other in a formal way at readings with, you know, audiences who are ready to listen to a fairly polished piece. And we can also read to each other pieces of work that's right off the page for the first time. And that's a very vulnerable, you know, experience to just read what you've just written. Yeah. That in and of itself feels like the old form of storytelling, where you're telling stories to your community and to your family mm-hmm. and to your broader but intimate network of people. And that's really great.
Yeah.
That's really magical. It's really... I've talked to friends who've published, you know, broadly, and we say, well, we have a local reading, you know, and there'll be 50 or 75 people come to the reading, and they'll look at me like, really? That many people show up for readings? Because, you know, this is someone with a reputation who goes to a bookstore to do a book signing, and they just won't get that kind of turnout. So this community really supports that practice of sharing stories in person yeah. in that way, reading to each other. And it's so great.
Yeah, because like back in the days before you could write, before reading and writing and publishing, it's like oral culture and oral storytelling. In today's culture, like what do they have to show for it?
Yeah.
It's just words in the wind, but it's not.
It's not, yeah. Yeah.
It's creating culture.
Yeah, my friend said, you're making the world.
Yeah.
You're making the world over and over again every time you tell a story. So it's pretty great. We live in a good place.
Do you want to say anything about writing groups, writing circles that are available that you like or would suggest?
Yes. So two things I would say about that. If you're looking for an experienced leader for a writing group, I would pursue anyone who's been trained in the Amherst Writers Workshop method. It's a very supportive, positive method where you would write together as a community of, say, a dozen people for an hour or so, and then those who want to read out what they've written with the feedback coming from the group, that is what works and what the group heard, what each individual heard was working for them, what stuck with them, what was vivid for them, what was intriguing and interesting to them. And this is a really opposite model of what a lot of us have grown up with, say if you've come from the university or or graduate school or scholarship, where you read something out and you're expecting, you feel like you're standing in front of a firing squad. In what ways has this failed? You know, where do you, you know, the critique method is very harsh. It can be. Mm-hmm. It can be really discouraging. So this Amherst Writers Workshop method is really the opposite of that. I think it's revolutionary. It's not brand new. It's been around for several decades. Mm-hmm. And Robin and Carol in the Gallery of Readers Press dedicates this anthology to Pat Schneider, and as well as Peter Elbow. Pat Schneider was the founder of this method. I'm not sure if founder is the right word, but initiated this method. And it's really, really very constructive. It's very forward-looking. The other thing I would say is if people want to write, it's a lonely process. It's a lonely practice if you're only by yourself. And to start a peer group, you know, doesn't cost anything. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a member of both kinds of writing groups. So one where there's an experienced leader and one where we just get together every other week and share company and food and write and laugh and cry.
That was Mary Beth Brooker of Northampton, who's involved in writing and the Pioneer Valley writing groups. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP, 103.3 FM in Northampton. You can hear archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. I actually wrote something, a story that I think there'll be enough time to share. But first, I just want to say hello to Dwayne Rainey, who showed up in the studio.
I can't say unannounced, but I said, I'm coming up. Yeah, I would like, I miss being here on Wednesdays with you and our talking back and forth, I guess you want to say. Because it does get lonely in the studio if you're just here by yourself. And I mean, I listen to music.
Yeah, well, Dwayne has his own show called My Generation.
Yeah, on Fridays from 2 to 4. Music from the 70s. And I got a little knob in here that I can like crank it up in my headphones. So I was like, yeah, I really don't care. But for a talk show, yeah, talking into space. But you have a story.
I have a story. So this is a story I wrote, which
is it written?
It's written. Yeah, it's written. It's a very long, convoluted story that's just like a rough story. And anyway, I'll just start reading it. You can
stay tuned next week.
Yeah, stay tuned next week. You can give me the signal, Dwayne, if I should just cut it off.
Okay.
All right. Once upon a time, there was a little breeze named Zephyr. Mostly Zephyr would travel gently with the other breezes that danced across the fields. But one day, a big gale came through and lifted her high above the land and carried her up into the sky and far away. She turned and twisted to free herself of Gale, but couldn't slip away. Finally, Gale's grip loosened and she slid out of the turbulence. But now she didn't recognize where she was. There was no land below, only water. Being a Zephyr, instinct told her to go east. So she did, the sun her guide by day and the stars her guide by night. But one misty, foggy evening, she suddenly ran into something soft and pliable that slowed her movement but didn't stop her. It felt like she'd gotten trapped, like in a sheet, and when she looked around, she saw other breezes trapped in sheets around her, all pushing steadily in the same direction. Zephyr noticed below her was not a vast ocean, but a wooden floor moving across the ocean. She kept pushing onward, though, headed in the same direction as all the others who had only known to blow out of the west all their lives. But one morning, Zephyr realized she was tired. She was tired of pushing up against that sail. Why should she have to push a sail her entire life? What if she just stopped? So she did. She just stopped. She dropped out and fell gently down past the side of the ship. And just before she touched the water, she noticed a name written on the side of the boat. The Empirate. She rolled across the waves like a balloon, thrilled to be free of the pressure of the sail. She was on her own now and could do anything she wanted. But still she felt a slight sadness for all the breezes that had sailed out of sight with the Empirate. She wondered at what point they would realize that the ship was at their mercy. She shrugged and the waves rippled. The ocean seemed endless again. Suddenly she felt all alone. She knew there were other breezes out there, but without a billowing sail or prairie grasses waving or soaring birds to make them visible, she questioned if they were actually there. And if they weren't moving something, then who were they? She went up higher in the sky to look around, and it was there that she noticed a speck growing bigger, coming towards her, a fluttering, dipping, diving dot, going in the same general direction as she was, but with more enthusiasm. Soon the seagull was upon her, barely even noticing as he sliced through her midsection with a flap of his wings. The gull kept going, but Zephyr caught up. Hey, wait! She blew faster and eased up under the gull's wings, speeding him up, then stalling and watching him dive forward. At first he thought she was just one of the many passing breezes, and he didn't pay her much attention. He was more interested in fishing. But she kept coming back to play. In fact, she always wanted to play. It got to the point where Gull had to tell her, "Look, I'm not a breatharian like you are. I've got work to do. I need to eat." She said, "I can help you. Tell me where you want to go fishing, and I'll take you there." He rolled his eyes at her persistence. But what could he do? He couldn't even see her when she was following him or floating alongside him, so it wasn't like he could stop her. And besides, he did feel like life was easier with a tailwind. Working with the wind, Gull found that he had more time to play. When they were going between fishing spots, Zephyr would come up under him at the same time he thrust his wings, and he would bounce up into the sky like a rock skips across the water. Or she would come at him from different angles and watch him adjust to her by changing his flight patterns. By now he knew to expect her at any time. But he wasn't annoyed, because he knew she just wanted to play and would always be gentle. Sometimes they would part ways, and the gull would go out on his own independent fish-finding missions, and Zephyr would explore all the different levels of air and atmosphere. She'd check out the updrafts and trade winds, and occasionally she'd catch sight of a monsoon. But she learned to recognize the gull even when he was just a speck in the distance, and when she saw him, she would quickly make her way over to play. She liked how his feathers felt pushing through her breath, and she liked to see the things he'd do when she blew. Then one day, in late summer, she felt something uneasy in the air. She searched the sky in all directions, and sensed out of the west a hurricane rapidly approaching. She looked for Gull and saw him skimming along the surface of the water, intently following a school of fish. "Gull, do you see the storm? Let's get out of here." Gull looked up with a fish in his mouth and gulped as he saw the storm. "Food for the journey," he said. "All right, let's go." He thought it was a good idea to avoid the storm, but he wasn't super worried. He'd known seagulls to fly along in the eye of a hurricane before. He didn't know why Zephyr was so tense. Zephyr took off fast, and Gull had to flap hard to catch her. "Hey, wait for me," he said. It was more efficient when they traveled together. They tried to fly ahead of the storm, but it was a fast-moving mass of air. They could hear the winds roaring behind them and around them as the storm started to close in. Gull looked back to see just how close the storm was, but in that instant he felt a sharp pain in his right shoulder blade as a piece of ship detritus, whipped up by the wind, pierced his wing. He careened off course, shuddered, fluttered, but Zephyr dipped down and caught him. She shifted her wind and put extra breath under the right side, lifting him up to level again. She wished she was stronger. All her life, everyone had called her Zephyr, the gentle breeze, born into a family of gentle breezes, but now she thought about changing her name, like to Willowa or Kara Burren or Finfing, or anything that made her believe she was more powerful. She wanted to be a surging, flowing, indomitable force bursting with light and energy. Being centered under Gull's right wing and breast, she could hear his heart beating rapidly and his breathing labored as he tried to maximize oxygen to his muscles. She realized she was wind, she was air, and she was a breath the size of the sky. Gull flapped his left wing as vigorously as he could, favoring his right, and as Zephyr began to tire, they veered south. The hurricane, miraculously, spun north. When a safe distance opened up between them and the storm, Zephyr let Gull down and he landed on the ocean. Finally, they could rest and float easy in the air and on the water again, and Gull could heal from his wound. When Gull took a closer look at his wing, he saw the man-made object that had hurt him so bad. With his beak, he pulled out the remains of a sailor's lapel pin. 5 letters remained. IRATE. Gull thought, "Irate! Yes, I do. That's why Zephyr thought me worthy to save." Gull paddled around, exhausted, yet feeling smug to be alive, and said to the breeze, "Thank you." But Zephyr shrugged and said, "I would have been blowing anyway. That's just what I do." And under her breath, she added, "Just not so hard all the time." She didn't realize that the entire time she was blowing lopsided, half hid under Gull's right wing, that her old nemesis Gale had been at the forefront of the hurricane. Gale had been looking for her, looking to take her back into the maelstrom. Gale had actually followed the Gull for miles, but Gale could barely see Zephyr and hadn't recognized the part she had seen. It was a narrow escape for Zephyr. So anyway, the rest of the story. So eventually Gull got old and died and was eaten by the offspring of the fish he had once eaten, and Zephyr, with her new power identity, she heard the call of the wind and she whipped across the ocean and caught up with the Empirate. Spun around to chase her tail 3 times, and all the ship's sails exploded, liberating breezes and a giant puff of shredded fabric, or maybe it was feathers, like a down pillow bursting. And the Empirate, it was no longer irate, just an imp. The end.
Well, you did have time.
Yes. All right. So that was a goofball story that I made up. My name is Ruthie Woodring. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio.
Are you going to publish that?
No.
I mean, that would be like a nice little kid story about the gentle little breeze.
Yeah.
I think I can. Little engine that could. The little breeze that blew.
Yeah, stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock.
Stay tuned for next week.
Stay tuned for next week.
I can hardly wait.
Yeah.
I hope I can sleep.
Yeah, so that story took it out of me. Now I can't think of what to say. There's 1 minute left. And you know what? I'll just play the
You're listening to WXOJ 103.3 FM in Northampton, streaming live on valleyfreeradio.org. And this is Out There.
Yes.
How's that?
Thanks, Dwayne.
My pleasure.